advisement. We move to the second case today, Walker versus Sheehan.
May it please the court, my name is Colby Ann Kingsbury, and I represent the appellant's inmate Frederick Walker. Mr. Walker brought these claims after he was attacked a number of times by guards at the Cook County Jail. He now brings this appeal after a series of errors were committed by the district court, both on summary judgment and during discovery.
Do we know what he was charged with originally?
Originally, he was he's in for crimes of murder right now.
I'm sorry?
He's in for murder right now.
That's what he was in pretrial detention for?
Yes.
The charge?
That's my understanding, yes.
This question doesn't have much to do with it, but why is he in pretrial, a pretrial detainee for 7 or 8 years? I don't understand that.
Your Honor, there's been a lot of things that have been going on in the court. They've been testing his competence and that type of thing, and I'm not exactly sure. We haven't been involved in that portion of the case.
It just does seem a little odd that you have this civil lawsuit and he's described as having been a pretrial detainee all during the period of time that the...
That's correct, Your Honor. He's still not yet had his trial.
He hasn't been convicted of murder?
He's not yet been convicted. That's correct. First, I'll address the summary judgment ruling here. Summary judgment orders are reviewed de novo. Because Mr. Walker has demonstrated material issues of fact with respect to each of his claims, the grant of summary judgment was erroneous and should be reversed. One of Mr. Walker's claims is that he was attacked by guards on September 8, 2004. Now, notably, the defendants did not move for summary judgment on that claim. Rather, after summary judgment had concluded, the district court invited the defendants to move on this claim. Mr. Walker supported his claim with substantial evidence, including his own sworn testimony and the testimony of 3 eyewitnesses and medical records that showed that Mr. Walker had suffered blunt trauma, bruising, and lacerations to his face. The injuries were serious enough to require a full battery of x-rays, stitches, and pain medication. Despite this ample evidence, the district court nonetheless granted summary judgment on this claim, stating only that Mr. Walker's allegations were conclusory. Next, the issue is whether or not Mr. Walker properly exhausted his administrative remedies with respect to his October 6, 2004 claim. Again, this is clearly a disputed issue of fact. Mr. Walker stated that he submitted his grievance, and then he gave it to a social worker. That social worker went off on vacation, and Mr. Walker was transferred to a different facility for a couple of months. He never received a copy of the grievance, and he never heard anything back from the grievance. This is not an unreasonable explanation. There is evidence in the record that shows that sometimes grievances don't make it in the files, and sometimes grievances are destroyed maliciously. Therefore, taking the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Walker, he has satisfied exhaustion as a matter of law. The jail did not respond to his grievance, and therefore exhaustion was deemed to be unavailable and exhausted. Notably, this is an affirmative defense here, so the burden is on the defendants, not on Mr. Walker. Mr. Walker does not need to show anything further or follow up on his grievance. The district court also dismissed Mr. Walker's January 11, 2004 and January 14, 2004 claims pursuant to the 2-year statute of limitations under Section 1983. And here, the district court committed clear legal error. The district court used the dates of the incidents and not the dates that those incidents were exhausted as required by Johnson versus Rivera. If you use the correct dates, then in fact those claims fall within the 2 years and should not have been dismissed. The district court also dismissed Mr. Walker's state law claims pursuant to the Illinois Local Governmental and Local Governmental Employee Tort, sorry, Illinois Local Governmental and Governmental Employees Tort Immunity Act. It's a 1-year statute of limitations. But here is the most clear-cut case of waiver as you're ever going to find. Defendants never raised this defense. They never raised it in their affirmative defenses, not in motion practice, not during discovery, not until summary judgment.
Wasn't the statute cited in the answer?
No, Your Honor.
Or in the motion to dismiss or in some sort of a responsive pleading?
The only thing that was that had been cited before was the two-year statute of limitations, which is the one under Section 1983. That was something that they raised in their motion to dismiss. This one-year statute of limitations was never raised.
But was this Illinois torts by public official statute?
The Illinois, that their provisions, they raised immunity defenses. Defendant Garrett raised immunity defenses from that act. He did not raise any statute of limitation defense from that act. And the defendants did adopt those, and that was allowed by the court. But again, no statute of limitations defense was raised, and that's an entirely different section of this 20-page statute. Pursuant to Ventures versus City of Delphi, then, the defendants should have shown just cause for the delay, since they did not raise it until summary judgment. Now, the defendants argue that they should still be allowed to raise this defense because there was no prejudice. But the Ventures case specifically says if Rule 8C is not to become a nullity, courts must not countenance attempts to invoke such defenses at the 11th hour without excuses and without adequate notice to the plaintiff. So here, the burden was on the defendants to show just cause for their delay. The burden is not on Mr. Walker to show how he was prejudiced. Next, the district court dismissed Mr. Walker's inadequate access to medical care claims.
Before we move into the substantive issues that are on appeal, I want to go back to one of these procedural issues having to do with exhaustion, in particular the one pertaining to the October 6, 2004 incident for which there is no record of a grievance having been filed. And it's my understanding we have a discrepancy in Mr. Walker's statements about that.
What happened, Your Honor, was there was an interrogatory posed asking us when grievances were filed. We did omit to add that one, but then during Mr. Walker's deposition, he stated that he did file a grievance, and it was consistent with the what I said before, that he gave it to a social worker, the social worker went on vacation, he never received a copy.
So he did testify to that at his deposition?
He did.
There is no discrepancy between the declaration he submitted at summary judgment and his deposition testimony?
That's correct, Your Honor. Those two things are consistent. Moving on then to the medical claims, because the officers caused Mr. Walker's injuries, they are required to provide him with prompt medical attention. And they did not do that, and this is pursuant to the Cooper v. Casey case. Rather, the officers delayed by doing such things as bringing Mr. Walker to the psychiatric ward to cover their tracks, and by falsifying medical records to state that Mr. Walker had denied medical treatment when he did not. With respect to Mr. Walker's official capacity claims, we've provided substantial evidence of inadequate training, officers who can't even answer the most basic questions about use of force, widespread complaints of excessive force complaints that have not been investigated. That evidence, combined with the extensive media coverage that is also in the record, shows that the jail officials were on notice of these claims and should have taken some action, and instead they were deliberately indifferent. Again, this claim should not have been dismissed on summary judgment. Now, in addition to summary judgment, the district court also made a number of errors on discovery. Decisions that are arbitrary and prejudicial to the complaining litigant constitute reversible error. This is particularly the case when the district court issues orders without providing any rationale or explanation for the decisions. Here, the decisions that were issued largely precluded Mr. Walker from taking any discovery on his official capacity claims. Now, the defendants argue that these orders should be allowed to stand because, according to them, they were not denied outright. But these are final orders. Mr. Walker has no obligation to continue to renew motions. Not to mention, this created a substantial burden on him for time, money, and energy to continue to go to the court to get discovery that he should have been entitled to in the first place. In addition to asking that these claims then, or these rulings, excuse me, are overturned, we also ask that upon remand that this be given to a different judge pursuant to Circuit Rule 36. Specifically, the judge found here that no reasonable jury could find in Mr. Walker's favor. Therefore, on remand, this same judge should not be permitted to preside over jurors who are going to be tasked with that same decision. Thank you.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David LaPorte, and I represent the Sheriff of Cook County in his official capacity and each of the individual correctional officers sued by Mr. Walker. I'll be using 10 minutes of the 15 minutes allotted to the defendants. My counsel for co-defendant, Defendant Garrett, will use the remaining five.
Why does Mr. Garrett have separate counsel?
I believe Mr. Garrett has separate counsel because he's no longer employed by the Cook County Sheriff's Office at the time of the suit.
Well, but would have an obligation to represent him.
Yeah,
if the acts were committed when he was employed.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why separate counsel that it was appointed. That was my understanding. Perhaps Mr. McGrath could answer that though, more completely than I. As counsel for the governmental entity in this case, so I'd like to focus my remarks on the Monell claims. If that pleases the court, obviously I'll be willing to answer any questions that the court has. I think the case law arising under Monell is both plentiful and well-established, and I don't believe that there's a serious issue over the interpretation of Monell and its progeny. The plaintiffs seek to impose Monell liability by establishing that the sheriff, that the use of force within the Cook County Jail is so well established, so widespread, so permanent, and well settled as to constitute a custom and usage. In fact, the de facto policy within the jail. The problem, though, is that the plaintiff's evidence in this regard is woefully inadequate. Basically, what the plaintiff has, as far as admissible evidence, is his own testimony that excessive force was used upon him. He has the claims of a couple of other detainees that excessive force was used upon them. And then he has evidence from a grand jury investigation that there were 783 complaints of excessive force. Complaints, not necessarily substantiated complaints, just complaints. Between 1983 and 2003, that works out to an average of just over 156 complaints per year. The case law is clear that simply pointing to a couple of instances of excessive force is not sufficient to establish Monell liability. Regarding the 783 complaints listed in the grand jury testimony, there is no evidence establishing a link between the number of complaints and whether those complaints are sufficient enough to establish either deliberate indifference from the sheriff or whether those are sufficient to establish that this has become the de facto policy of the Cook County Sheriff.
Does the record disclose whether the plaintiff has a gang affiliation?
I'm not aware of that being in the record, Your Honor. There must be some competent evidence, though, that the number of excessive force complaints exceeds what would be expected if a constitutionally permissible use of force policy was in place and was, in fact, enforced. There's no evidence. There's no evidence making that link. It's not sufficient for the plaintiff to simply say, well, there were X number of complaints. There has to be some evidence establishing the link between the number of complaints and whether or not that's sufficient to establish Monell liability. That's completely lacking here. Plaintiffs attempt to establish Monell liability through a lack of training. And under the case law, what's required is a showing that there is a lack of training establishing that the sheriff is deliberately indifferent to the constitutional rights of the inmates. There also has to be a causal link, that the lack of training is a driving force behind any constitutional deprivation. Again, all of that is lacking here. The best plaintiffs can establish, and we need to construe the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the best plaintiffs can establish is that there is some variation in how frequently the officers are trained in the use of force, and there's some variation in how well the officers are able to recite under the pressures of a deposition exactly what the use of force policy is. There's no dispute that the officers were trained in the proper use of force, the constitutionally permissible use of force, and there's no evidence establishing that the sheriff's use of force policy is itself unconstitutional.
You know, if we put those Monell claims aside and look at the individual claims here, it seems difficult to say there are no material issues of fact that are involved in those individual claims.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that there are issues of fact. I don't think there are genuine issues of fact. And for a fact to be genuine, it has to be believable. And
So an inmate in a jail says, a guard beat me up unnecessarily. That's usually the only evidence that they have is their statement of what happened. Now, they give stuff about what kind of medical treatment followed and whether that's consistent with the or absolutely totally implausible with the plaintiff's story in that. But
well, Your Honor, I think of an example might illustrate our point. Say, for example, the plaintiff testified that the guards took a baseball bat and with two hands cracked him across his skull. And three, four, five, however many other witnesses say the same thing. But the plaintiff is immediately taken for medical treatment, as is the policy of the Cook County Sheriff. Whenever there's a use of force, the inmate is taken for medical care regardless of whether the inmate is complaining of injury. But he goes immediately for medical care, and there's absolutely no evidence substantiating the allegation that the plaintiff was struck upside the head with a baseball bat.
That's a pretty vivid example, struck upside the head with a baseball bat.
Well, certainly, but I think it illustrates the point that just because there's a question of fact doesn't make it a genuine issue of fact. This case isn't quite that dramatic, but it's not so far from that either. The plaintiff claims that he was struck repeatedly for a period of 5 or 10 minutes, the amount of time I'm up here in oral arguments, with handcuffs across his face. No evidence substantiating that. He claims that he was kicked repeatedly. Again, no objective medical evidence substantiating those allegations. Yes, he was taken. He had injuries, but according to our expert, those injuries were consistent with the appropriate use of force under the circumstances.
Yeah, it seems to me that's a great argument for the jury and why the jury should reject a claim like this. But on summary judgment, I'm having a difficult time saying that this is an appropriate resolution of this case on summary judgment.
Well, I think once we came forward with our expert, I think it was incumbent upon the plaintiffs to come forth with something rebutting that. Coming forth with something.
But they, in the real world, they usually don't have anything. You know, if an inmate says a guard came in and kicked me in the groin and I went down to the floor in terrible pain and all that sort of stuff. It might all be BS, of course, but that's...
Your Honor, under those circumstances, I think you would have a case where somebody could say that. You would not expect objective medical evidence supporting that claim. There's nothing we can look at objectively from a medical standpoint substantiating that claim. But here, that's the allegations that Mr. Walker is making are all allegations that where you would expect to see objective medical evidence substantiating the claim, substantiating the excessive use of force. Not the use of force. There's no dispute that there was force used upon Mr. Walker. Whether or not that was excessive or not is the issue.
What prompted the use of force?
Mr. Walker has a very vile habit of concocting a mixture that he puts into a bottle of urine and feces, and he uses this to spray the guards. He's used it on other inmates. Even the testimony from his witnesses, one of his witnesses states that he didn't see Mr. Walker using this concoction, but he could smell it, and the smell was overwhelming. Another one of his witnesses substantiates the claim that Mr. Walker was disobeying orders to exit his cell. As counsel alluded to, Mr. Walker has some competency issues, which affect his ability to stand trial. He has some psychiatric issues.
Is he still a pretrial detainee?
It's my understanding he's still a pretrial detainee. I see I have about 5 minutes left. The medical denial of medical claims, again, Mr. Walker, his major complaint in that regard is that he was often taken to the psychiatric ward rather than for medical treatment. I don't think the guards can be faulted. I don't think that establishes deliberate indifference by any stretch of the imagination, that they made a determination that he was more in need of psychiatric care rather than medical care. And in any event, when he's taken to the psych ward at CIRMAC, there are doctors on staff there. There are medical nurses on staff there to evaluate his medical needs. And if he needs to go for medical treatment, that's arranged. Absolutely no evidence that the guards were deliberately indifferent in providing medical care for Mr. Walker. And again, summary judgment was proper in that regard as well. I see my time is limited. I'd be happy to address any other questions that the court has.
Was there any relationship? What was the relationship between the witnesses and his witnesses and the plaintiff, other than they were inmates?
Other than they were co-inmates, and that they were, I'm not aware of any other type of relationship.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Alistair McGrath. I'm here on behalf of Defendant Garrett. To answer your question, the reason I was appointed as counsel is due to a different matter not relating to Mr. Walker's case. There's a conflict between Mr. Garrett and the Sheriff's Office. So due to that conflict, I'm here for this case as well. I'd like to kind of jump in to the September 8th incident, because I think that's of most importance to not only this case but to my client, because that's really the only fact pattern that applies. What the trial court did is, if you look at page 17, it disregarded the allegations made by Mr. Walker, and it did so because it found them unfounded. Now, this was within the scope and the right of the trial court, because according to our medical expert, his testimony was implausible. If you take a look at the September 8th incident, he claims that my client, Mr. Garrett, repeatedly, a man 6'3", 240 pounds, used handcuffs as brass knuckles, beat him repeatedly in the back of the head. Our expert took a look at the medical reports. He said you'd expect to find concussions, some kind of blunt trauma to the back of the head. There was nothing there. He repeatedly went through signs that you would possibly see given the allegations made by Mr. Walker. But in the medical records, our expert came back and said, impossible. Couldn't have happened that way. Now, plaintiffs want to argue that expert witness opinions can be disregarded for a trial. The case they cite, though, has to do with policies and procedures. What's the right way, whether a cop or a police officer should leave their keys in a car or not when they're going to interrogate or go after a criminal? This is not a case of policy or procedure. This is a case of impossibility. If you look at the medical records for September 8th, the allegations made by Mr. Walker could not have happened the way he said. So what the trial court was given was two sets of allegations, allegations by Mr. Walker and allegations by correctional officers. According to our expert, the only allegations that could have happened factually are the allegations that were made by the correctional officers. So when the trial court's left with two sets of allegations, one that's impossible, the onus was then on plaintiffs to come back with their own expert to say, you know what, there is actually some medical evidence to state that this incident could have happened the way alleged by Mr. Walker. That did not happen here. The reason being, once again, his testimony was impossible. Now, we go back a little bit to, there's two other witnesses that said Mr. Martin was also involved. Now, one of those witnesses made the same allegations, except instead of handcuffs being used as brass knuckles, there were shackles. Once again, if you take a look at the medical documents and the testimony by our expert, it could not have happened. Obviously, there was just corroboration between the two inmates who were talking to each other. As opposed, and with regard to the other inmate, which was inmate Willis, There's a nice letter in the record which shows Mr. Willis is being paid for a statement by Mr. Walker. I believe the letter said something to the effect of, "Dear Freddie, I'm going to testify for you today at your deposition. Make sure when the lawyers are cutting the checks, I get mine sent to me, and just make sure my family gets it." Obviously, I think the trial court can disregard the testimony he gives and find that there's credibility issues with it. So when we're talking about weighing credibility and weighing facts and something for a jury, that's not what we have here. What we have is, it's not a weighing of facts, it's we have facts that are basically not credible and could not have possibly have happened. And that's why the trial court was just and right in disregarding them and finding that the self-serving statements made by Mr. Walker should not go to a trier of fact. With regard to the state law claims, first, I guess, to answer your question, I believe notice was given that an affirmative offense dealing with 1 year statute of limitation. Defendant Garrett said he enjoys various immunities from liability in connection with plaintiff's state law claims, including, and he does go into list various immunities listed underneath the Illinois Government Tort Immunity Act. Now, he doesn't specifically list this particular section of the statute, but he does put them on notice that there are various immunities under this act under which he enjoys privileges. I think this is sufficient for the liberal notice pleading requirements. Plaintiffs argue in their reply brief that this is a one-year statute of limitation and not an immunity. If you take a look at the statute of limitations for these types of claims, it's generally 2 years under Illinois law. Under the Illinois Government Tort Immunity Act, it says government employees are given immunity between years 1 and 2. I think it falls within the proper notice of saying this is an immunity for within that time frame. Even assuming that proper notice wasn't given originally, the district court still had authority and discretion to allow an affirmative defense to be amended at any point in time. I think if you look at the case of William v. Lamp, it's on point here. One last minute, I know I'm up, but basically, I believe the plaintiff argues Vinters, but Vinters is distinguished from this case because the first time a statute of limitation defense was brought up was in the reply. And here we actually had it in the initial summary judgment motion, and they were given an opportunity to respond. All they can argue is waiver because the actual merits state that the one-year statute of limitation applies and that all those claims should be thrown out.
Thank you. Ms. Kingsbury? You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll respond to a couple of those points. With respect to the official capacity claims that defendants were first speaking about, as I mentioned, this was the type of discovery that was essentially precluded on discovery. We weren't allowed to take...
What discovery did you want?
Your Honor, we asked to interview a number of the witnesses. We asked for 97 boxes of discovery that included those 783 complaints so that we could look at those. That was from the grand jury investigation. We asked to take the deposition of certain other guards, and we weren't allowed to do any of those things.
Well, there were 30 depositions that were taken.
Well, there were, I think it was 26 or something like that, defendants in this case. So we were given the opportunity to depose each of them. There was also two 30B6 depositions. And when we asked to depose the guard, it was before we'd even gotten up to 10 depositions at that point. We hadn't even started to take depositions of the defendants. Also, what I kept hearing from the other side was that they're essentially arguing the facts and credibility here. This is inappropriate for summary judgment. The fact
there
that Mr.
can be impossibility arguments, of course.
There can be, Your Honor, but you know, here that I think was with respect to the medical claims. You know, they have an expert here. This expert, though, could not testify. If you look at the record, he could not testify to whether or not that force was excessive, whether or not excessive force was used. He said he wasn't there. He doesn't know. So all he's looking at is a very limited amount of information that's provided by the defendants. He wasn't even permitted to look at the entire deposition of Mr. Walker. So he's looking at limited information. He's not entitled to any higher status than Mr. Walker just because he's an inmate. Again, we had three eyewitnesses here. Now, they did point out that one of those witnesses wrote this letter. Well, there are still two other witnesses that stated that Mr. Walker was beaten on September 8th.
It's a pretty damaging letter, though. You admit that.
Well, Your Honor, even, you know, even if we discount that person, there are two other witnesses. And those witnesses have testified they don't even like Mr. Walker. So, and I'm pretty sure that that's true. So, you know, this is not the time and place to be arguing credibility. There's substantial evidence, even if you discount that one inmate's testimony. Now, the other thing that was brought up on the medical claims, well, they argued that there's no signs that, the officers were deliberately indifferent. Again, that's not the standard here. There's a heightened standard, a standard of prompt medical attention, because it was the guards themselves that caused the injury. And they say, you know, oh, well, they took him to the psych ward. That's good enough. He had visible injuries, including bleeding from his eyebrow, and yet they take him to the psych ward. The psych ward turned around and sent him back to the ER. So clearly they were not equipped to be handling those types of injuries. That was
Yes, but by its very term, psychiatric is a medical operation, I would assume, isn't it? Nurses and doctors there?
You know, I don't know. This is the first I've heard that they have medical doctors there, to tell you the truth. But even if they did, Your Honor, what was appropriate was that they would take him where they know he could get medical attention promptly, and that's not what they did. You asked, one of the judges asked whether we knew about the relationship of the inmates. Again, I want to point out that, several of them don't even like Mr. Walker. And also, you heard the defendants argue that these injuries couldn't have been caused, that this was impossible. And he said because there was no blunt trauma. Well, in fact, the medical records show that there was blunt trauma to his face. And, you know, Mr. Walker is on his hands and knees on the ground. He doesn't know exactly who's kicking him. And he doesn't know, you know, all he knows is what he sees before he falls to the ground and he's being kicked. And then lastly, on the... on whether or not the one-year statute of limitations defense was raised. Again, this, you know, them raising immunity defenses from that same statute does not by any means put us on notice of a statute of limitations defense that is in, I think it was in Section 8, they raised immunity defenses in Section 2. We're not required to view the whole statute as something where they might bring some defense that's located in there within this 20-page statute.
You asked for a Rule 36 application. If this is remanded for a jury trial, why is that going to make any difference?
Well, because, again, Your Honor, the judge presiding over the jurors would have a bent or a mindset, and it would be, I think, more appropriate to have a different judge who wouldn't have that bent or mindset that a reasonable jury couldn't find in Mr. Walker's favor. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be